Let's resume. What we were talking about is a way of trying to create a predict function so that we could have our parser be sharper. If we can get to the point, and we will, that the parser always makes a correct prediction under all circumstances, parsing becomes really very trivial. At each stage, when you see a terminal, you match it against the current input. If you see a non-terminal, you do a prediction and say, this non-terminal must have expanded to these symbols, possibly including lambda, and repeat the process. So it's a matter of match, predict, etc. And in fact, we'll come up with a nice little implementation, which is actually something that people invented before the theory existed. It's one of those cases where people invented a parsing technique that was very intuitive, but they didn't have the theory behind it. And then the theory we're developing now explained why it worked and how you could have confidence that the program would always work. One of the difficulties of programs, of course, as you all well know, is you can test the Dickens out of a program, and that does not guarantee that there may not be a fault that you haven't thought about that's hiding behind the scenes. In terms of having the theory behind it, you say, I don't know, I don't care what productions you give me, if the following tests are valid, then predictions will always be correct, and therefore the parser cannot make a mistake. The user may give me an incorrect input, and even in those cases, I can tell the user, here's a symbol which I believe is incorrect. If you give a correct input, I'll find a parse for it, and because of the way the prediction works, it'll be guaranteed to be a unique parse. That's basically because predictions are always unique, so there's only one way to ever build a tree, and that has to be the correct way. So we are shown here that we did an improvement from what we had previously, because in the case of identifier, I have only two choices. In the case of an if or a read, I only have one. If I happen to have a label, I have, in this case, I haven't made a choice yet, but in that particular situation, I just have to figure out how label is handled, and then I'm good to go. So in that particular case, I don't have to figure out exactly which statement yet. I just have to figure out for a label which one to go. So let's take a look further at that. So we'll match production only if the next unmatched input symbol is consistent with the predict set for a production. If a symbol predicts all the productions, you still are no worse off than you were previously. You try them all. But with careful design, you're going to eliminate those which can't possibly work and focus on those that are possibilities, therefore making fewer backtracks and speeding up the process. In fact, we'll get to the point where we're guaranteed to always be unique and correct, and that'll mean a linear algorithm, no matter how big the program is. But we still have this problem that we kind of tap danced around lambda productions. Remember, prediction says if we see a symbol that's consistent with what the program, with the non-terminal generates, we'll predict it. But if something goes to lambda, it doesn't generate anything. Now, one way you could say is you always try lambda productions just in case. But again, that getting away from our goal of being smart about our predictions. So what we're going to do is something that I kind of talked about last lecture, that if I'm trying to predict something that goes to lambda, I'm not going to look at what is generated by the non-terminal, because that's nothing. But I'll try to find what symbol would have to follow next after the non-terminal did, in fact, generate lambda. So the notion was, remember, that if I come and drink a vial of some a magic potion that makes me invisible, you won't see me anymore, but you'll see the wall behind me. And that's an indication that you hear my voice, but you don't see me, but see the wall, that, hey, he must have gone invisible. Or, in our case, the symbol must have generated lambda. So mathematically, and this is just so that we can do computations and actually program this, there exist parser generators that generate top-down parsers, just like CUP generates a bottom-up parser. So it says, suppose I see a production A goes to lambda, and I want to know what to predict on that. It can't be lambda. Lambda's invisible. So it says, let's find all the symbols that can follow A. There's the definition. It says, in any program, if I see a capital A, what symbols can follow after it? And in particular, we're going to only want the terminal symbols because terminal symbols are tokens, and that's actually what we see from the user. So if I see a symbol that can follow the non-terminal A, I'll say what might have happened is A went to lambda, it disappeared in effect, and what I now see is not A, but rather what follows it, in this case happened to be little a. So that'll be our trick there, and I'll show you a tangible example. So in this particular case, if I see label goes to lambda, I'll say, what can follow a label? Well, an identifier or an if or a read. So if I see any one of those three tokens, I say, hey, the user chose not to have a label. If, on the other hand, I see an integer literal, where I'm using a number as a label on a statement, then since the integer literal is distinct from ID, if, or read, I say, okay, that's the case where the label actually did exist. I'll match an integer literal followed by a colon. But again, I'm able to distinguish between the two based on what my next input symbol is. If it disappears, I see something that follows it. If it doesn't disappear, I see something it generates. So let's go ahead and do some parsing now. In this case, we're going to do a little backtracking. Then we'll figure out how to actually improve the grammar so that even that little bit of backtracking disappears. So what we see here is a call to a method or a subroutine. So there's some identifier, that's the name of the method, a left paren. It takes a single parameter that's an intlet, close paren, semicolon. So it looks very much like an ordinary call. Well, in this particular case, we're starting with statements, and the initial token is an identifier. So what we're going to say is, well, one of the things that can be predicted is the very first statement production. Notice we don't know that this is going to fail because we haven't gotten deep enough to see the equal expert business. So we say, okay, I see an identifier. If label went to lambda, identifier would be correct. So this is a real possibility. I give it a shot. I then say, okay, what am I going to do about label? Well, I look at the current input. It hasn't been matched yet, and that's an identifier. So that says, oh, that must mean label was lambda. He chose not to give a label on that particular statement. Fine. I match identifier, but now I go ahead and see the open paren, and that does not match the equal, the assignment. So I say, this doesn't match. I must have made a bad choice. So I back up and say, well, I must have a different alternative for statements. But now I don't try the second or third statements because that's if and read, which doesn't match the identifier. So I go ahead and try the other alternative for an identifier, which is the method call. So I say, okay, statement could have gone to that production instead of the one I tried. And now let's continue our logic. Identifier is my next input. It's a situation there where label must go to lambda. Identifier matches, left paren matches. I don't have all the rules for args, that is arguments, but surely an integer literal can be a valid argument. So we'll assume that matches, right paren and semicolon, and bingo. I was able to make the correct choice with one backup. It's not ideal, but previously I would have had to try four backups, trying the first statement, then the second, then the third, and finally the fourth, which is the one that worked. So what I can do is when I have a non-ideal grammar, I can rewrite things a little bit. And in this particular case, I'm going to first start with what we have there and rewrite it so that the label appears on only one choice. So I have label followed a basic statement, which is one of those four possibilities. I still have the assignment versus method call problem. So what I'll do is I'll go ahead and say a basic statement can be an if followed by a statement suffix, and there are the two suffixes, the equal expert or the arguments. This looks a little unnatural, but the advantage of that is I delay making the choice between 1 and 4 until I see more input. So I say if I see an identifier, it's got to be 1 or 4. So I have this production that's called a statement suffix that says, I know it began with an ID, and I'll either do an assignment or parse the arguments in parentheses. And one of those two has got to work. Now I don't make a bad choice, because if I make a choice of an identifier, it's going to be one or the other. And as soon as I see an assignment or a left paren, I can make the choice. So now we have the following table with predictions. And this doesn't look particularly special, but it turns out this is absolutely perfect. When we see one of these, it's you know, like winning a minor lottery prize. It's not like winning the big one, but you know, even a couple of bucks is handy sometimes. And we say, okay, I've got to make predictions. What can go wrong? The only thing that can go wrong is for the same non-terminal, I make the wrong choice. Well, the very first non-terminal statement, I can't make a wrong choice. I don't even need a predict set. There's only one choice. It's got to be that. So statement one is no problem. Statements two, three, four all begin with basic statement, but notice they have different predictors. One is predicted by ID, the other is predicted by if, and the third is predicted by read. Can't make a mistake. Depending on which symbol I see, I do production two, three, or four. Statement suffix has two choices. One is predicted by a left paren, the other is by the assignment. They're different. Can't make a mistake. Finally, I have two label choices. One is an integer literal, and the others are if, ID, or read. Can't make an error. So now all of a sudden, using this grammar, notice it generates exactly the same language, but now it's a situation where I have a better grammar. My parse for any valid input is guaranteed to succeed. Is it each choice, it'll make a prediction, but it can't make a wrong choice because each terminal symbol makes only one prediction. So it's always this guy, that guy, and you don't make a mistake. Therefore, you never have to back up, and because you never have to back up and retry things, it goes from potentially exponential or cubic to linear, which is the best possible. So looking at this, let's redo, just to make sure we're comfortable with it, that example I had a couple of slides back where I have an identifier, a left paren, arguments, and a right paren. So at the very beginning, it says, okay, I know I have a statement. Only one choice, so it's going to be label and basic statement. The first thing I see is identifier. I say, okay, of the three basic statements, which one is predicted by an identifier? The answer is number two. So I have an identifier followed by a suffix in this particular case. Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped over the label. When I see the label, I see an identifier, and it goes to lambda. So it disappears, and then I do the second production, ID statement suffix, no doubt about it. Okay, statement suffix, I match the ID, and I see a left paren. Of those two choices, the one with a left paren is match a paren, args, close paren, right paren. I don't have args productions, but again, we'll assume they match the int literal. There's the right paren and the semicolon, and I'm done. So now I made no wrong choices. I always made exactly the right choice, and I would for any valid parse. There's no way this guy can ever make a mistake, because if it's valid, there's only one prediction that'll ever work. If it's invalid, maybe none of the predictions work, in which case I simply say, hey, this thing can't be generated because I tried all the possibilities conceptually, and none of them are predicted by what I currently see. So if you see a blatantly bad symbol, you say, hey, that doesn't work in this context. It must be erroneous. Please rewrite the input to have the correct symbol there. And that's just a normal parse error. So as it says here, as long as their predictions are unique, they must be correct. And if they have no predictions at all, that's the signal of a syntax error. We never mispredict, so we never back up, and therefore we never waste any time or space. So it's guaranteed to be fast, i.e. linear. Why is it linear? Well, if you think about it, each symbol in the input is processed and matched once. I never have to go back and unmatch anything. And that's sort of a first step towards linearity, but it is, in fact, linear. In fact, this is so nice that we go ahead and give an unbelievably bad name to the technique. Now, again, here's a case where you could have come up with something better, but again, it's these technical things. So as I said, if you go to the doctor, they always have these unbelievable terms for various body parts. And you know, say, you know, what happens? You know, in the situation, my knee is bad. Well, whatever it is, it's not a knee. What's the doctor term for knee? Patella? I don't know, something. Okay, patella. No, you've got something in patella. No, and it won't be inflamed. They have another term for inflamed, you know, and on and on and on. So here's the situation where we could have had a simple name, but we have this thing LL. Now, just, it's not totally out of left field. So let's see what LL really means. And it's such a stupid choice, but it was done. So there's three components here that are really important. L, and the parameter 1. Well, the first L means, da-da, we're going to parse left to right. I don't know any parser except maybe for a language that is read right to left, like Hebrew or Arabic. And I don't even know those exist. I think they do, but I've never worked with one. So everything parses left to right, but it's still there. This is parsing left to right. What's the second L? Well, it's doing a leftmost parse. Remember way back I talked about you can do a leftmost parse or a rightmost parse. It's doing a leftmost parse. So run from the left, create a leftmost parse. And what's one? It says you get to see one token at a time from the scanner. In theory, the scanner could give you 2 tokens, which would give you more information, or 3 or 4 or 5. In practice, 1 is enough. So LL1 says I'm going to read 1 token at a time, read them from the left, create a leftmost parse. Okay, it makes sense if you understand the technology, but it's one of those sort of situations where it takes a while until you figure out what the coding scheme is. I remember it used to be the case that, I think it still is in fact, that some European cars have this crazy coding scheme, but if you understand what it means, it's pretty fine. So like you can go and buy a BMW, and they used to have a 300 series, a 500 series, and what is a 700 series. So the first number is small, medium, or large. But even a small BMW is not that small. And then the next 2 digits would be how big the engine was. So years ago, I had a 540, which was a middle size. That's the 5. And 40 means a 4.0 liter engine, which is a pretty good size engine, and so on. So it's the same sort of thing. You have to understand the coding scheme. And once you do, you say, oh, I know all about what's going on. Now, companies have started to kind of deviate from that, but it's still, in the old days, it used to be pretty easy to understand what it meant. So that's what LL1 means, and I know you didn't much care, but since it's used in the textbook, we better talk about it. So an LL1, think of that as the ultimate top-down parser. It is a context-free grammar whose predict sets are always disjoint for the same set of non-terminal, or same non-terminal, and therefore cannot make a bad prediction. They'll parse from the left, do a leftmost derivation, use 1 token at a time, and never make a mistake for valid input. For invalid input, as I'll show you, it'll complain about it and give you information about what symbol is most likely wrong. It's always hard in some sense. You may have noticed this even when you're writing code of your own for the business. It's sometimes hard to say exactly what's wrong. It's not so hard to say, this is not what I wanted as input, but is something misspelled? Did you make a wrong choice? Is this impermissible because it's crazy and it would not be allowed or whatever? It's one of these difficult things. And it's something that's the hardest thing is to explain clearly why a program is unhappy. So that's just what I said. So here's the mathematics of it. And again, don't let this terrify you. It's simply a way of giving a mathematical definition so that if I ran an algorithm, I could automatically have a test. So let's first define what it means to have the first symbol from some number of terminals and non-terminals. So it says the first symbol is take x1 through xn and let x1 through xn derive some number of terminal symbols, and the first one is A. If it's included, that's the first. So first says, I am the first symbol derivable from that right-hand side. Follow, as I said a moment ago, are those terminal symbols that can follow a particular non-terminal that's used for that lambda business. So these are just mathematical definitions. Well then, how do I predict a particular production in LL1 terminology? It says, if the entire right-hand side can generate lambda, that's usually because it is lambda, then take anything that's derivable from that symbol and add in the follow via union. Otherwise, if it can't generate lambda, the symbol must be generated from x1 through xn. Compute first and give me all the symbols that might appear first if I chose to match x1 through xn. That's the basic definition. And if in a homework or an exam, and in either the midterm or final, I might ask about LL1. I'd say, how do I know if something's LL1 or not, or is this LL1 or not? All you have to do there in that case is show that predictions are either unique or non-unique for a given non-terminal and a given terminal. And That's one of the beauties of this, is the definition is really pretty easy. So it's like, I got to make a prediction, guarantee that prediction is unique in that if the symbol is valid, there's one choice. If it's invalid, there are zero choices. But there are never two or more choices, because that's where I get back into that backup business. And so if I happen to have two productions that have the same left-hand side and different right-hand sides, all I require is what I said a moment ago, that the predict sets are disjoint. Anything that predicts the first production doesn't predict the second, and vice versa. As long as the predictors are, the intersection of the predictors are disjoint, then it's LL1. I can parse it top down and I'll never make a mistake. So why do we like LL1 grammars? They're easy to parse since predictions are always correct. And all you ever do is one of two things. If you see a terminal, you try to match it. If you see a non-terminal, you do a prediction and say what production that non-terminal must have used as part of the derivation. So very, very easy in terms of choices. So here's an example that fits on a slide and has some lambdas in it just to give us a little choice on this. So first of all, we'll say how these things got computed. But suppose I just ask you, here's the productions and here's the predict set. Is this a good top-down grammar? That is, it LL1? All you have to do is say, well, let's look at the number of productions that begin with S. There's only one. Doesn't matter. This thing, if there's only one, that's got to be the one predicted. No problem. Number two has only one choice. No problem. It has to be predicted properly. Three and four both share B, capital B, but they have disjoint predictors. That's fine. The last two, which are D's, have disjoint predictors. They're fine. So if these predict sets are in fact valid, this is a great grammar to parse because each prediction is guaranteed to be unique. So let's see where those predictors came from. Let's start at the top. So it says S can go to an A followed by little a. Well, what can A generate? It can generate a B or a D. A B can generate a little b. A B can go to lambda and generate little d. Or A can go to B and D, both of which go to lambda, in which case I see the A. So A, B, and D all predict that first production. But again, there's no choice about it, so it doesn't really matter. Production number two, what predicts it? Well, B can generate a little b, or it can go to lambda, and D can generate a little d. Or B and D can go to lambda, in which case I look at what follows A, and that's little a, so that's included. But again, only one choice, so I really don't need it, but I just wanted to show I could compute it. B goes to little b is trivially b. B goes to lambda says, what follows b? Well, a d does, and d could generate little d. Or d could go to lambda, in which case I'd have to follow a, and what can follow a is little a. So b and d predict little b goes to lambda. D goes to d is trivial. D goes to lambda, what can follow d? Well, what follows d is what follows a, and that's little a, and there it is. So that's just a little bit of exercise. At some point, if you're preparing for an exam or something, you might want to bring that slide up and just kind of mentally walk through it to make sure you're comfortable with what's going on. Okay, so that's the theory behind it, but let's go back in history and see some of the earliest parsers people really built. Well, in the old days, people didn't do all this mathematic type stuff. They wrote programs. So good programmers write programs. And what they came up with was really kind of a clever idea, which still has a lot of value. And that is the sense that what I'll do is I'll simply write something called a parsing procedure. Let me write that down. It's kind of a cute idea. And what a parsing procedure does, it's the bit of code that is responsible for parsing exactly the input from one particular non-terminal. So think of it as kind of like being an expert. I don't know if any of you are on the Epic helpline, but somebody calls in and you say, program so-and-so is going crazy, I need to talk to somebody. Somebody, you know, there are all sorts of programs. Is it a top secret? About how many programs is Epic retail and maintainer? Is that top secret? Is it a dozen, 100, 1,000? You don't know, but somebody does, and they collect the fees, right? They say, there's got to be somebody that has this great spreadsheet that says, you know, know, this guy is making us $2 million. Oh, that's not so good. This guy's making us 10. That's better. This guy's making 100 million. Oh, that's great. But anyway, no matter how many projects you have, I know you must have more than one. There's on the helpline, there's going to be somebody saying, oh, okay, they're having trouble with this one. Call Bill. Oh, no, Mary's in charge of the other one and so on. And you get to be an expert. So any question that comes up on this particular product, you got to answer. Well, what a parsing procedure does, it says, no matter how the other routines work, you call me and I'll parse whatever is generated, not from anything in the program, but from one particular non-terminal. And in that particular case, we have a series of little experts, one for expressions, one for declarations, one for statements, and so on. And the cool thing about this is, you may have wondered when you're first learning programming, when we talked about recursion, we talked about the fact that most recursion is self-recursion. So you have some mathematical formula like factorial that's defined in terms of itself. But programs can be mutually recursive. A can call B and B can call A. But the question always comes up, what the hey good is that? Well, it turns out parsing procedures are a great early example of where mutual recursion is handy. Because what might happen is, when I'm parsing a statement, I may have to go down and find an expert. If I find an expert, I may have to go ahead and parse within an expert a simpler statement. So it might be that the components are all interactive, that something depends on something else. So that's the notion of what we're going to do. And let me show you. It's really kind of a cool idea. And the nice thing about this is this existed when there were no parser generators. This does not need a parser generator. It is simply code whose logic is based upon the LL principles I've shown you today. So a parsing procedure is responsible for parsing a sequence of tokens. So how does it begin? Well, let's say at the beginning we're doing a program. So we have a non-terminal called prog, and therefore we have a parsing procedure called prog. So we tap prog on the shoulder and say, do your thing, guy. It starts matching symbols, but I say, hey, a component of a program or a prog are declarations. So I call another parsing procedure that says, hey, you're the guy or gal who does declarations. Do your thing. After those things are done inside declarations, there may be something that involves an expression. I call a third party that says, hey, you handle expressions. Go and do your thing. And after it's matched just the right number of symbols, it returns back and says, done, and you continue on. So let's take a look at that. It sounds complex, but it's really, once you get used to it, kind of nice. And this is called recursive descent because, A, it's recursive. Back in the old days when recursion was kind of uncommon and therefore kind of something that people were interested in seeing. And it's a descent because it's a top-down parser. It starts at the root and works its way down, recursively calling routines. So a statement may be in another statement, a declaration may be in a statement, and they all sort of intermix. But in writing those, you simply have to have a little bit of code that handles only the productions for a particular kind of non-terminal. So the guy handling statements doesn't worry about anything but those statement productions. Therefore, each of those is fairly easy to write, as you'll see in many cases, a single line or two. And therefore, it's pretty easy to build by hand. Of course, easy to screw up if you don't understand the theory, but that's the downside. So let's build a recursive descent parser. First of all, we're going to need a little utility routine. And I'm sorry about the way this thing broke. This sort of thing, I tried to get it reformatted and it would not behave itself. But we need to have a trivial routine that says, I'm expecting to see this particular terminal symbol, go and match it. So if I'm expecting to see it, so in the beginning of CSX Lite, you expect to see a left brace. So you say, match a left brace. And one of two things happens. If it's the case that the current token is a left brace, you match it. All that means is you consume it, call the scanner and say, okay, I've taken care of left brace, give me the next token. So I update the variable called current token to get the next token. So I always have a variable say, here's the token I'm currently looking at. I'm going to try to match all of them until I get to the end of the file, in which case my parsing is done. If the thing doesn't match, it says, I was expecting a left brace and you show me a class. Why is that? Well, you're going to see that if you haven't already. What's going to happen at some point is you may change over from CSX Lite, which expects a left brace, over to full CSX, which expects a class. If not everybody's been informed of the change, there's going to be a mismatch. Maybe you're giving it a light test program and feeding it into a CSX parser, or vice versa. you have a CSX-like parser and you're giving it a CSX program. So something like that. So matching is certainly possible to fail. In this case, we just generically say, give me a syntax error. In terms of CUP, I've given you a little bit of code. It does syntax error messages, so you don't need to change it. You can use that just as it is. But that's something we need to worry about. So one of our elementary routines is match. This is very simple. The current token better be this, and I'll tell you exactly what it is. If it is, fine and dandy. Otherwise, we have an error situation. The harder part is we're going to build a parsing procedure for A. So I'm going to get together and find all the A productions. If there's only one, it's particularly trivial, but generally there'll be more than one. So I have the ones involving the X's or the ones involving the Y's or dot, 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 maybe some others. Don't know however many. And my parsing procedure is going to have to decide which of those productions to match. Now we have the benefit of LL theory, so we can have a way of deciding this. In the old days, you kind of look at the productions and scratch your head and say, well, if I see an identifier, it's probably the first one. If I see an integer literal, it's probably the second. And if you forgot about something, that might not be covered, and all sorts of human error. But now we have the predict sets, what I showed you earlier, and those can actually be used to make the decision. Hey, parsing procedure for A, are you going to try to match X's or Y's or maybe something else? And let me show you how that's decided. So here's a whole sequence, and here's a generic form. And by the way, it's not going to be that complex, but this is just a generic form that you have. You say, I'm responsible for doing A's. So how do I handle that? Well, maybe it's X1 through XN. Well, there's a predict set for X1 through XN, and if the current token says I'm predicting that baby, what I'm going to do is match each of the particular symbols on the right-hand side. Well, X sub I is just a way of getting at a particular symbol in the right-hand side. If it's a terminal, I do a match. If it's a non-terminal, I do this odd thing that says X sub I with parens, which says I extract the I symbol from the right-hand side. It's a method, and therefore I'll call it. You say, wait a minute, this is not in Java. It isn't, but we're not actually going to program it this way. There are, in fact, some languages that allow this. And just think how cool it would be if Java did allow it. You could have an array of different methods and call one or the other or a third. So you might have a method that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. So you say, okay, here's a list of methods that work well in order of their preference, maybe how reliable they are, how fast they are, how efficient they are. And we'll try the little things. So, we'll try one of the ones. Does that work? Nope. Well, I'll go and try another one, and another, and another. There's certainly cases where that would be very handy, because in real life, and I'm sure you see that in your job, one particular solution does not always work. Sometimes one gives you a reasonable answer, another one doesn't, and you may have to try an alternative. So it's sort of a difficult situation in general. But this is just a generic form. And if you have something that's not predicted, if you have a symbol that's not predicted by any of those productions, then you must have a syntax error. So this looks hard, but let's go ahead and actually improve it by looking at a real grammar and a real parsing procedure. So this is pretty much very similar to what we've seen previously. We now have something that looks like CSX Lite. It's got a couple of kinds of statements, an ID and an if. It's got an expr that's an identifier followed by pluses or minuses. And notice this is LL1 because each case where I have more than one production with the same left-hand side, the prediction sets are unique. That's true for statements. There are two choices. It's true for statement, which are two choices. And it's true for etail, which are three choices. So it is LL1. And here are my parsing procedures. And golly, doesn't this look like real code that you could actually code in Java or any other language you might happen to like? So it says, what's prog? Prog has only one possibility, so I don't need to predict it. I just do it. What does prog say? I begin with a left brace, so I simply call left brace, and the string in there means match that token. So it's a little bit of abbreviation, because remember, we're matching tokens, not strings. But for readability's sake, match that token that corresponds to the token left brace. So for our readability, easy to do. Then call the parsing procedure for statements. Its job is to match zero more statements. when it says, I'm done, I've done just that, it comes back and says, match the right brace, and then match end the file, which is a way of verifying that you consumed all the tokens, that there's not anything left. What is statements? Well, it has a choice. So let's go back just a moment to that table. Statements had a choice. So I'm going to say, is the next token, the current token, I should say, a right brace, or is it an identifier or an if? In one case, I do production number 2. In the other case, I do production 3. So in this particular case, statement says, well, am I seeing an identifier or an if? And this is just straight, you know, Java-like code. If I see either of those, I call 2 parsing procedures. I say, one, match me a single statement, presumably something that begins with an identifier like an assignment, or something that begins with an if, like an if statement. And then match statements, which will match any residual statements. Otherwise, if it's not the first choice, it must be matching lambda. How do I match lambda? By doing nothing. I just return. It says, lambda says there are no more statements, therefore nothing more to match. I'm out of here. We have a statement which has 2 choices. Is it an identifier, assignment, or an if? So it says, if my current token is an identifier, match the identifier, match the assignment, match an expert through a parsing procedure, and match a semicolon. Otherwise, it must be an if, match the left paren, match an expert, match the right paren, and then match a statement. So notice it's following the grammar very nicely, but this is code. I can actually implement this. The only thing I could screw up, of course, is getting my predictions wrong. That's the spot where having the theory and maybe having an automatic tool that does it by computer rather than by hand so I don't make any mistakes is an issue. There's one other negative thing about this, and that may or may not be an issue, is that if I build parsing procedures for a language version and somebody comes up with a new version, I may have to rewrite a lot of code. Suppose somebody goes in and says, hey, we have a new and improved language that has this new feature or that new feature. That may change the predict sets, it may change what I have to match, etc. So this thing is well-suited if I have a fixed language. It's not so well-suited if my language is changing. That's where, again, having automatic tools like CUP is great. Because if you're doing it all the time, you're adding this production and that, and you say, CUP, regenerate my parser to accept a different set of symbols because I've added new productions. So automatic tool makes that easy. Doing it by hand doesn't. But the great thing about this is that you have to have absolutely no support tools. And again, it's one of these issues that I'm sure you have this issue here. There's a lot of great software floating around, but a lot of it has various kind of odd rules. For example, there's some that are done by the free software. It's not a corporation. Foundation. Free Software Foundation. It says you can use all these great tools, but if you accept the copyright or whatever they call it, it's not quite a copyright, anything you generate with that tool has to be free. I guess that's something your company doesn't want to do. So in a lot of cases, if you use free software, you want to make sure that it doesn't impinge on your ability to then sell that software as your own product. This thing, on the other hand, doesn't use anybody else's software. Or if it does, it's not so visible. If you use somebody else's software and you didn't admit to it, you're not in trouble until the opposing lawyer starts questioning you. And then you decide to tell the truth or not. Now, being deposed is not, I've been deposed a couple of times, and it's not always the most fun because they kind of ask all sorts of unpleasant questions. Like, who's bribing you to tell a lie and that sort of thing. But anyway, that statement, let's continue on. Here's an expert, that's real easy. Match an identifier and then an etail. And there's an etail. It says, if you're a plus, match a plus and an expert. If you're a minus, match a minus and an expert. Otherwise, you must be the null tail and do nothing. And that is an entire parser. Assuming you already have a scanner, this code properly coded in whatever language you have, C or Java or C++ or C# or whatever. I don't know. Would Cache support something like this in roughly this form, where you had a series of recursive calls that did matching of symbols and that sort of thing? In theory, it could. I mean, in practice, I don't know. But no, it's probably doable also in Cache. I don't know if you actually have tools that do that or not. But the cool thing about this is a real working parser. And particularly in the old days, when parsers were still something that was fairly revolutionary, you could actually see what's happening. So this thing is just matching, following the rules of the productions. And let's see how the guy works. I mean, it's really cool to see the thing work, because what we have here is we have a series of pending calls. All that means is when I decide to choose one right-hand side or another, I don't do all the matching at once. I do a call to this and then a call to that and so on. So let's assume we have A gets B plus C with braces and the file, a valid program. We're going to have remaining input, and I have all that showing just so we can see where we are. But remember, if you're a parser, all you see is the leftmost symbol, and that's called the current token. And what happens at the beginning, you say, well, all programs begin with prog, so I call prog, and there's the remaining input. That just starts things off. I then say, what does prog tell me to do? And it's got a list of things to do, and I'm stacking those from top to bottom. So the topmost guy is what I'm going to do now. Those remaining ones are pending calls. But that's okay. Remember, in recursion, you have a routine that goes to sleep while the guy you call executes, and then you return and finish out the call. So it says, okay, match a left brace. That's the actual call that says, is current input a left brace? If it is, consume it. That means effectively throw it away, call the scanner, and make the next input token the current token. So brace matches brace, fine. Match is done. So I go down, and my next thing is statements. So statement says, if I see A, which is, of course, an identifier, what does the thing tell me to do? Well, it says, change statements into match a statement. I know I have at least one, and then match remaining statements. So it's going to change statements from one symbol to two. Why? Because that's what the production's told you to do. It says, okay, if I see a statement and an A, what happens? Well, it says, well, that's either got to be an assignment or an if. Clearly, it's an assignment. So it sets up the code for an assignment. It says match an ID, that's the left-hand side, match an equal, match an expr, and match a semicolon, and then remaining things on the stack were things that were pending under statements. So it's recursion, and it's just stacking things to do, and the top guy is what's executing. Match an ID, that works. Match the assignment operator, that works. So I go down one level, I get to expr. Expert says, if I see an identifier, match the identifier and an e-tail, an expert tail. Well, B is an identifier. It matches. So I go down the plus and e-tail. Remember, in e-tail, I have the choice of plus, minus, or lambda. Clearly, plus is the one I'm going to want to do. So in this particular case, match a plus. Yep, that works. Get down to expert, sees an identifier. Expert says, that's match an identifier and an e-tail. C matches an identifier. I get down to e-tail. E-tail, when it sees a semicolon, says, go to lambda. So effectively, it just disappears itself. That's null. I showed that there. So it essentially does nothing, which is the same as returning. Match the semicolon, fine. Statements sees a right brace. Again, that's the case of null. So effectively, statements does nothing, returns. I then match right brace, match end the file. I'm done, and my match all worked. I consumed all the input. I know for that because end the file only appears in one spot at the very beginning. All my input's done. So notice it's nice and mechanical, and no matter how complex the program, it does it step by step. Never makes a mistake. It always predicts the right thing, never has to back up. And you can see it's pretty fast. Because all it's doing is pretty trivial things like saying, what production does this guy predict? You can imagine having a table that's indexed. We'll show you a way to automate that in a bit. But it's inherently pretty straightforward. So it ought to run fast. In fact, here's one of the oddities, or you might think so. If I were to time in a real compiler, a scanner and a parser, which do you think would be faster? Forget about the rest. You know, forget about type checking, code generation. Just take the timing when I'm in the scanner and take the timing when I'm in the parser. Which is likely to be faster, would you guess? Well, you got a 50-50 chance, but intuitively, it kind of looks like it ought to be the parser because it's doing more complex things, but what's the alternative? What's the other side? Scanners are doing things character by character, whereas the parser is doing it by token, and there are fewer tokens and characters. Yeah, but I just said faster. I'm not saying, I mean, if one is slower, the ratio is probably going to stay the same. I agree with that. But just you time it, you know, is it the tortoise and the hare, or is it two real great athletes, or whatever it is? And it turns out in many cases, the scanner is the limiting factor as compared with the parser. The parser is really fast because it's so linear. It's simply make a choice, it's got to be the right choice. Make a choice, it's got to be the right choice. So in that case, although parsing is certainly harder, you know, if I ask questions, questions may seem more complex. It's still the case that it implements very nicely, which is something we're happy about. Well, wait a minute. I only gave you half the problem. Again, something you probably know from your own work is working with correct input is fine. But the hardest part in a lot of programs is what happens if I get garbage, the old garbage in, garbage out. How do I recognize that something's invalid and how do I react to it? You know, particularly when you have to interact with users. You know, you say, no, you don't know what you're doing, fool. Get out of here and find somebody who does. You may wish to do that, but I mean, it's not something you can probably do. You got to be very, very precise about it and polite, I guess, also. So how do I handle syntax errors in this case? The beautiful thing is I don't have to do anything extra, really. What will happen is, although it's not obvious, that if I have an error in input, this thing will find the error and find very close to where the error most likely occurred. I say most likely because you can't always get in the head of somebody and know what they were thinking. They could have been thinking something way off, you know, out of bounds. But if it was simply a simple error, they forgot to type something or mistyped it or got something out of order, that's something where you say, this is where I think the error is, and you want to point them to something pretty reasonable. Now, again, you're experienced enough that if it says, look at this symbol, you probably look at the symbol before it and after it, because all they're saying is something around here, not necessarily guaranteeing this is the bad symbol. Let's see how that works. It's going to find it. And as I said, it's going to find it as soon as possible. That means it's not going to be misled by something to say at the end of the program, oh, guess what, by the way, your program was invalid. If it finds the error, it's going to find it immediately when it sees the symbol and says, there's no way this symbol, in conjunction with what I've already read, is going to be valid. And that's the basis for saying you believe the symbol that doesn't fit is the one that's erroneous. Well, how is that going to happen? Well, the way it's going to happen for an error is one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to call match and match is going to fail. That's great. That's where you get these really cool error messages where we're saying error, identifier found, left brace expected. Something you can really say, not only what was wrong, but here's what I expected. Because match always knows exactly what it wants. The alternative might be that you're doing a prediction and the symbol you see doesn't predict anything. There you really don't know what the user might have been thinking, except that this symbol doesn't fit, because if we're valid, it has to predict one of the valid productions. If it predicts none of them, it can't possibly be right. But again, it's reasonable to say this is the bad symbol. And let's go ahead and look at an example of this. And this, by the way, I don't know if I mentioned this or not, but this is the way really assignment statements ought to be. So it's one of those situations. If you found, you know, Mork from Ork or somebody, you know, from another planet who really understand the way computing ought to be, that being might write down assignments like that. So that's of course, invalid under our syntax. So we're not saying in the greater scheme of things which is the better solution. We're simply saying what's allowed or disallowed. But just to make a point, why is that way of doing assignments probably the way assignments ought to be written? That's right. Remember, when you learn an assignment, what does an assignment statement do? It says, evaluate the right-hand side into a value and then assign it to the left-hand side. But typically, code runs left to right. So it's a situation there that B plus C is needed before you get to A because you have to compute B plus C and then dump it into A. So when you actually go ahead and do the assignment the usual way, what happens is you see A and you got to sit on it for a while. Then you evaluate B plus C or maybe something way more complex, get a number or a string or a character or whatever. Then go back to the left-hand side, which has been sitting waiting, and say, at last, I have the number and you're good to go. Or maybe it's a situation, you know, it's like going, I was at the restaurant in the Union South today, and what they do is they give out little numbers. So I ordered a very, very simple thing. So mine was number 244. So I'm sitting there, 245, not me, 246, not me, 247, not me, and finally, I say, come on, have I gone disappeared? Finally, they call 244, and it's out of order. So it's kind of like sitting, waiting for, in this case, B plus C to be computed, or for my sandwich to be finalized. I don't know if they ran out of bread or whatever, but it seemed like it was going to take forever. So let's see how this works, and it's really kind of cool, because I'm not changing the programming at all. It's just a consequence that bad programs will reveal themselves. So in this case, now we kind of know that this is a bad program, but one of the first questions you want to ask is, where is the earliest that a parser, which reads token by token, has a reasonable chance of finding an error, knowing that this is the wrong way of doing an assignment? Is it going to find an error when it sees the left brace? The answer is no, that's fine. When it sees an identifier, in this case B, is that going to tell it anything? The answer is no, because that identifier is going to be misconstrued as the beginning of an assignment. But when it sees the plus, it's going to say, uh-oh, something bad here. I expected to see an equal, and I saw a plus, and that's bad. So let's kind of trace it down. It matches the left brace, sees statements, and sees a single statement, and matches that as an assignment, because the identifier has to be an assignment. It can't be an if. So it keeps going for a bit. It then says, oh, match and equal, and I see a plus. So all of a sudden you say to yourself, that's not going to work. That's invalid. So in this case, you print an error message saying error at position so-and-so, assignment operator expected but not found. Now, the user may still be confused if they think that's the way assignments ought to work. But at least you've explained in the context of what you know to be valid what you wanted and what you didn't want. So in this case, the match fails and you terminate. So parsing procedures are where it all started. There are a couple of drawbacks to parsing procedures, one of which is you got to do a lot of coding by hand. You might prefer if, just like it was the case of the scanner generator, that the system simply produced tables and that a standard piece of code would run from the tables. So different grammars have different tables, but the same parsing logic. And that's exactly what we're going to do. So now you can change the grammar and the parser will come out automatically, kind of like a cup does, and you don't have to build any parsing procedures. On the other hand, if you'd like to have the procedures around as something to see and understand, that certainly is a plus of it. And historically, that's why people liked it. It took a little while for these things to catch on, but now they're pretty well accepted. So these are table-driven top-down parsers. So recursive descent are attractive. They are actual pieces of code, and people love that, can be read by programmers and extended. Notice if you wanted to, you might be able to actually do more processing than just parsing. I'm not sure if that's good, because one of the fundamental rules we've learned is sort of compartmentalize your responsibilities. You normally don't want a program that tries to do everything in one module, because if that module screws up, everything's screwed up. That's one of the reasons why we have a scanner and a parser and then a type checker and finally a code generator so that different components can be maintained separately, tested, and debugged separately. And again, I assume much of the code you do is the same deal. There's one unit that does this thing, another unit does that, and they interact through very definite interfaces. But being able to be read by programmers and extended was cool. So you could understand how parsing was done. And again, if you're unclear on parsing, how parsing works conceptually, look at parsing procedures. They really do tell you what's going on. When we go to table-driven stuff, it's a little less evident because now we're hiding things in terms of encodings, whereas the parsing procedure was plain old logic. If it's this, do that. If it's that, do that. And if you understand programming, you understand parsing in parsing procedures. Turns out, as I said that, you can do this business about adding things to build an AST or do type checking or code generation. But again, that may or may not be a blessing. It's kind of like a little mom and pop job where you own the whole project. That's fine. But if it's a real project in a real company, you have to have several people working on it, and then boundaries have become an issue. A drawback is that it's inconvenient to change the grammar, and particularly what happens if you have things like type checking or AST building, and you change the grammar, how much of the stuff stays, how much gets thrown away. Contrast that with CUP. With CUP, you can add new productions, but existing productions don't change. You can say, hey, I have a new kind of statement in there, and I'll handle it. But how I parsed all the remaining statements stays unchanged. So it's much more modular in that each production has its own little rules, and they don't interact, except possibly the extent that you have something where you add a rule and the parser is no longer able to build a valid parser. Then you go back and say, well, the new rule that added was problematic and I may have to do something about it. So minor changes may force parsing procedures to be reprogrammed, and predict sets may need to be changed too. So maybe it's better if we do this all automatically and have every time a minor change comes in, rebuild the parser, and we're guaranteed to have one fresh and up to date. It's a minor problem, but still an issue, is that parsing procedures are also a little less efficient because method calls in programming languages are fairly expensive. It's not obvious yet. We haven't gotten to that point yet. But if I decide in a piece of code to do A plus B, or I call a method that says called sum that takes A and B as parameters, goes into the method, does the sum, and comes back, they both gave me the same result. But doing the sum the second way is way less efficient because the overhead of stopping your current execution, going to a new method, setting up the method's execution environment, running it, getting its result, bringing it back and using it, all costs time. So this thing is likely to be slower. Again, parsers are pretty fast, so it's not a big issue, but if you can make something that's more reliable and faster, that's a double win. So the alternative is going to be, we're going to take the we're going to take the prediction, which is the key idea of parsing, and put it into a table and have an automated system that decides what production is being matched and a data structure, particularly something called a stack, which all the 367 guys remember, is something that will actually hold information that is pending processing. And we'll see that in just a moment. So what we're going to do is we're going to create a table. Like all good tables, the table's named T. It's only a two-dimensional table. And essentially in this particular case, the prediction says, here's a non-terminal that I want to match, and here's the current token. So one dimension will be the tokens, and the other will be the non-terminals. And an entry will say, here's the prediction I have, or if there's no valid prediction, it'll be blank. Oops. So let me... Oh, this is a good place, I guess. We still have to talk about the structure. So let's take another 10 minutes, and it's essentially 7:40, so we'll see you 7:50. We'll do the final half hour, and then we'll be good to go.